from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from Stanford Children's Health, the Bay Area's dedicated physicians network exclusively offering pediatric and obstetric care. More at stanfordchildrens.com. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And Digital Foundry, working with leading organizations to jumpstart digital innovation. More online at digitalfoundry.com.
Today on the California Report, a special holiday edition exploring the wide variety of ways we love in the digital age. Join us as we say grace over FaceTime with a San Jose family separated by the Mexican border and U.S. immigration law.
Papá Dios, gracias por esta comida. Te pido que bendigas a mi familia.
We'll dive deep into the difficult teenage years with a family in Berkeley and talk to one mom who used her daughter's smartphone to keep tabs on her.
I kept texting, "Where are you?" And she kept telling me, "Oh, at this other party." And I could see the little dot moving around. I said, "You know, I'm just coming to get you."
And we'll talk to a couple who only met after their parents met each other using a matrimonial website.
Both our families liked each other. That was the foundation for our love story.
I'm Rachel Miro, and this is the California Report. Today we're revisiting Love in the Digital Age, a series and podcast exploring how technology plays a huge part in our emotional lives. Join us as we spend a little time with three families this holiday weekend. I produce the series together with Polly Stryker, who's here in studio with me.
We'll be hearing first-person stories, but there are no experts today, except in the sense that we're all experts when it comes to love. Every year, the holiday season pulls family members together.
But also points out who's not in the room. Loved ones who've passed, and those physically separated from us for all sorts of reasons. Military service, prison sentences, U.S. immigration law. As many of these families know, technology helps keep everybody together, at least emotionally speaking.
And that's the case for one San Francisco Bay Area family. Here's the story of Jorge and Magda.
After roughly two decades of marriage, Jorge Arreola of San Jose and his wife Maria Magdalena Ortega Delgado, or Magda as everyone calls her, have more or less been forcibly separated from one another. It could be devastating. It is devastating. But they've used this opportunity to create a third country of the heart online.
Half of myself is over there and half of herself is over here with me.
She had to leave the country for 10 years for overstaying her visa.
She won't be able to come back until 2022.
She's been there 3 years, and she has 7 more years to go.
You can get to a depression by just thinking over and over and over about the same thing.
So Magda could have been arrested and deported, but she decided to leave voluntarily. So she went back to the village where she grew up, where she still has relatives. And now she and Jorge stay in touch with FaceTime.
We call them Margaritas. It's like a small village. It's like probably 3,000 people living here. Very simple people, but with a very warm and big heart. So you are welcome to come anytime if you want to.
So, Polly, you spent time with Jorge and Magda in this virtual space. Did they ever get to the question of what Magda was doing in the U.S. illegally?
She'd come to see her father a couple of times. He was here legally with papers. And right when she was around 20, she came again, and she came on a tourist visa, and she stayed.
Overstayed?
Yeah. She thought she could be part of her family's immigration package, but when she married Jorge, that changed her status in the eyes of the immigration authorities because she was no longer a child and she couldn't be part of her family's immigration package anymore. And
even though he's a U.S. citizen?
He's a U.S. citizen, and they tried for years to adjust her status. They thought they could, but ultimately they couldn't.
How often is he visiting Magda and Margaritas?
They see each other every few months, and, you know, it's not all sadness. They manage to have some fun.
He loves movies. I'm not very into science fiction. He loves science fiction. But, well, we take a turn. Sometimes I watch his movies, sometimes I watch my movie. Even though sometimes I get asleep, but I'm there with him.
You watch that?
He writes little poems for her. He sends songs to her. They're texting each other. You know, they talk about little stuff, their families. It's all the stuff of a marriage, like how's the dog doing, how's the garden growing, even the new gate.
I haven't seen the fence, the gate. I haven't seen it.
Oh, you want to see that?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see if I don't get disconnected, okay? I took my iPad and I go all around the town and show the traditions for us and share with, not only with him, with all the rest of my family. Like right now, some of the trees are blooming and I have a little fruits. And I say, I saw him. Look at what I'm eating. You know, the people is passing by. I said, look at, say hi to my husband. And, oh, your husband, hi, how are you doing?
Jorge's in a rondallas group. It's a Spanish guitar group. And he sings and records songs for Magda's birthday and sends them to her. There's a song called Yolanda, famously sung by Cuban singer-songwriter Pablo Milanés. It was played at their wedding 21 years ago.
Why didn't Jorge just move to Mexico or move to San Diego so he could be closer to Magda?
So Jorge has a well-paying job at a company in Silicon Valley. He works as an equipment engineer there. And he says, you know, if he went to Mexico, he'd be fixing computers in a corner store and making cents on the dollar. And, you know, there is another reason. They have godchildren here, a couple goddaughters, a godson. They're young. And Jorge and Magda are very close to them. And Jorge's torn. His life is here, and so was hers. Their house was the gathering place for the family during the holidays.
Our house was like a grandma's house, because I'm the older in my family, so all my sisters and brothers, we get together for the feast, for everything, for the holidays. Last year, I was in charge to do the blessing during the Thanksgiving and Christmas and all those kind of things. And they called me, and I used the iPad, and I was able to see each other and see all the food, and I sent my bless and for the food. Papá Dios, gracias por esta comida. Te pido que bendigas a mi familia, a toda la gente que está aquí. Dales pan a los que tienen hambre, hambre a los que tienen pan, y te pido por todos los que hacen posible que llegue esta comida a esta mesa. Amén.
I wonder whether they're distressed has drawn them closer together. They can't take each other for granted.
I don't think either one of them would ever have wanted this. What a terrible situation to be in. But in a way, this has made them rededicate themselves to one another. They can't get angry, you know, for a couple days like sometimes other couples do. They don't have that luxury.
Our souls are together. And I know when you are sick, I can feel that. I know when you are sad, I can feel that too. And I know that you do the same thing. And I just want to tell you that it is not easy. During the day, I can smile, I can talk to people, I can do my dance and everything. But when the darkest come and I have to go to my room, this is the hardest part. The hardest part, because there's nobody there.
I felt like I was in the room with her after a while. It's interesting. We kind of forgot because we were all talking so deeply. And yet we weren't. She was just on a flat screen. And it's really jarring when they say goodbye. Because you say bye and it gets switched off and you're like, oh, the person's gone.
I'm going to go play soccer tonight.
Okay.
Okay? I love you, Mama.
Bye.
I see you.
I love you too, Papa.
Bye.
Bye. Have a nice day.
You too.
That was Jorge Arreola and his wife, Magda. He's going down to Mexico to visit her for Christmas. Family ties can be surprisingly resilient, and most people will tell you there is nothing stronger than a mother's love. That's not the case all of the time, of course, but this next story is proof positive.
Let's meet a mom who used technology as a window into her teenage daughter's life and simply refused to let her go off the rails.
Few things are more painful than watching someone we love harm themselves. Most parents go through this experience in some form or fashion when their kids become teenagers, but some families suffer more than others. One mom in Berkeley, we'll call her Donna, found herself caught up in a high-stakes game of cat and mouse with her daughter, Cindy, starting in middle school when she was 13. To protect the family, we've changed the names.
I was in the car, and I looked over. My daughter was in the front seat, and she was holding her phone. You know, she kind of scrolled through, but, well, your first thought is, why is there a male torso on my child's phone? And then I thought to myself, oh gosh, it's, you know, this is happening.
I got to tell you, Rachel, as a mom, I've seen a lot of stuff written about this, but there is no personalized playbook for this stuff.
I would see sometimes text conversations that would be between her and someone that I didn't know, and I assume actually that she didn't know. If I could ever really see the whole gist of a conversation, I would gather that the person on the other side was a boy or a man who eventually would kind of lead the discussion to something sexual, and then it seems like she would kind of stop.
Donna was checking Cindy's phone on a weekly basis, looking for stuff like this. But Cindy was deleting anything sexual, anything that would spark a lecture or worse, grounding. And so it took some time for Donna to fully understand what she was up against and to fully understand the severity of Cindy's depression.
My depression came in like waves. So I'd be like sitting here watching TV and I'd be like, oh, it's all fine. And then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, wow, like, why am I even alive?
She's looking back on this experience after a lot of therapy. Cindy was an anxious kid, and when she hit middle school and felt socially excluded by the girls, it was kind of a mean girl situation at the school she was at, she sought out boys.
I really wanted attention, and I didn't really care how people thought of me, and so it was like, I'm going to text this guy a million times until he finally stops replying, and then I'll find the next one.
And if that meant reeling them in with sexually charged photos and conversation, that's what she did.
It's so easy. You just, you know, snap the picture and send it. You know, it takes nothing.
I mean, outwardly, she's a bright, beautiful kid. There's really no reason for her to be depressed or anxious, but some people are.
Cindy fell in with a couple of girls who were cutting themselves, and worse, cutting themselves competitively with each other.
They look like what they are, razor cuts, so they're very thin and precise, but they can get a little deep. I know, it's horrible.
And then unbeknownst to Donna, Cindy got into the cocktail cabinet and started playing around with alcohol.
Let me guess. She took a little bit from each bottle and made jungle juice, the kind of thing her parents wouldn't notice.
Exactly. It's a gross concoction, but it gets the job done.
Unfortunately, high school didn't go as well as we had hoped for her. By her sophomore year, she had gotten with, again, a group that was kind of fringe, not exactly motivated in school, and they were smoking a lot of pot.
stepping back a bit here, we're all of an age, you know.
Yeah.
We grew up at a time when a little bit of smoking wasn't considered too bad, you know. Why was this different? Why did this feel different?
Everything that Cindy did would go from zero to 100.
By sophomore year, Cindy was smoking, by her own estimate, 8 to 9 joints a day. And then drinking on top of that.
Did Donna ever really clamp down on Cindy?
She really thought that if she punished me, I'd hurt myself. She was scared that something terrible like that would happen.
But it was more than that, Polly. The phone was a surveillance device for Donna. This was a way for her to keep tabs, however limited, on Cindy.
It was Halloween, and there was, again, a negotiation. I want to go to this party. It's at, like, kind of this preppy kid's house. Everyone's going. I remember it was raining that night.
So Donna drops Cindy off at the party and goes home. But then she proceeds to watch Cindy's location, following that little blue dot as it moves along Telegraph Avenue, which is not where the party was.
Probably trying to score something. I kept texting, "Where are you?" And she kept telling me, "Oh, at this other party." And I could see the little dot moving around. I said, "You know, I'm just coming to get you."
Was there any part of you that thought, you know, all right, I'm disappointing my mom, that's one thing, but that where you just thought, you know, this is a roller coaster and I need to get off it?
No. That's when I was like, I need to find better parties.
Things started to go downhill. It just went downhill really fast. And I realized again from looking at her phone that she was financing her pot use by selling it.
You know, at a certain point, you have to reach for outside help. Did Donna do that?
Oh my gosh, did she do it? Talk therapy, antidepressants, more than one, dialectical behavior therapy.
A common form of therapy used for kids who cut.
Which involved classes for both Cindy and Donna.
And it wasn't just myself, it was my husband. It was, at this point, we have a team of people who are trying to help her.
Nothing they could do in Berkeley seemed to be working. So they got Cindy to agree to go to the other side of the country for 2.5 months for what's called a wilderness therapy program. It's basically an intervention. Cindy was separated from everything, her friends, her drugs, her iPhone.
I didn't need it as much as I thought that I did. I mean, there were people to talk to. Like, I was never without people. I think that was the biggest thing I needed a cell phone for, was to be with people.
Technology aside, one of the biggest positives about the wilderness therapy was that Cindy was forced to come clean with herself and with her family.
I probably shouldn't have trusted her as much as I did.
Wow, that's a really hard thing to say.
Yeah. I will never not regret the pain that I caused my mother. Like, I always knew that she loved me. She cared enough to repeatedly go through these things with me and not give up.
Cindy's really lucky. She gets to reboot her life.
She does. But she's also really lucky she got the parents she did. This family wasn't willing to let her go down that dark path alone. Cindy's now deep into her freshman year at a prestigious university on the East Coast. Donna's back east, too, celebrating Thanksgiving with Cindy and relatives there. For many of us, the thought of letting our relatives choose who we marry seems, well, unimaginable, maybe even horrific.
But in cultures where parents still play matchmaker, it makes perfect sense. And these days, they're using modern technology to find matches.
About 3 years ago, a young man by the name of Prashanth Vishnu Mangalam Narayanan of Fremont in the San Francisco Bay Area found himself at SFO, embarking on a trip to Edmonton, Canada, his mission to meet the woman who might become his wife.
So a lot of things run through your mind. I'm going cross country to meet somebody just on the fact that I've talked with them over phone, and I'm going to make a big decision in my life.
So several months before SFO, Prashant's mother and his aunt put up a profile for him on a matrimonial website called BharatMatrimony.com.
Whoa, let's back up here. The parents write the profiles for their own children?
I know. But Rachel, these are not dating websites. The idea going in here is marriage, not relationships, not dating, but marriage. And they're really big in India and also with Indian expatriates around the world. In fact, one of the largest of these websites, Shadi.com, says it has upwards of 200,000 account holders registered in California alone.
Wow.
Yeah. So sometimes the prospective bride or groom will set up their own profiles, and other times the parents will set them up.
It would be the way my mom would describe me to somebody else, saying that, oh, he's a Iyer Brahmin, he doesn't eat meat, he doesn't drink, he's a good boy, he's done his bachelor's, he's done his master's, and based out of California.
Prashant learned about this woman through his parents, who in turn learned about her through a profile set up by her parents.
Both our families liked each other. That was the foundation for our love story.
That's Gomati Ramakrishnan. She was studying for her master's degree in Edmonton, Canada, and it turns out that she and Prashant are from the same city in South India, Chennai. So back in Chennai, the parents were browsing profiles, they liked what they saw, and they decided to meet.
Okay, the parents met first.
Yes, the parents met first. The arranged marriage concept is about the family. It's not about the individual. And the first question is, are the families compatible?
His parents, they were really down to earth, and both of them got along well because both of them came from middle class family, and they had, based on their hard work, they were able to come up in life. So that was something that both of them have mutual respect for. And that's something that I also wanted in the person that I was going to marry.
They would call this semi-arranged because they actually spoke for about 9 months before they got married, which is a long time.
For arranged marriages.
Yeah.
How I put it is, I got introduced to the person I was getting married through family relations and connections, but then we talked and we really understood each other and got married.
Prashant flies to Edmonton, and then what happens?
It was only when he got to the airport that he realized he was finally going to meet this woman he'd been talking to for several months now. She was there at the airport to pick him up. He was late. It was a long weekend. It was actually Canada Day. And they went all over the town. They ate. They walked. They went and saw a movie. Gomati says at first she was a bit quiet, which is not like her. She's full of life and bubbly.
It sort of felt really weird. I know this person. I can talk to him over the phone. But when he comes in person, I was just observing him more than talking to him.
I found her very exuberant. It wasn't an aha moment. It was kind of a growing realization. You talk more and more.
He's athletic and he plays badminton, so she was also watching him, I think, as a handsome young man.
Yeah, I wanted the guy to be fit too. Like, I mean, I felt that the guy should hit the gym.
Then when he left Edmonton, there was no decision. She was stalling a little bit.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I was. You need to understand the person really well before getting married because it's a one-time thing and you just don't want to screw it up. So that puts a lot of pressure. Even though parents put a lot of pressure, it's, you know, you just don't want to make a decision until you know, yes, this is it.
I felt kind of sad when I went back without any decision. I thought initially I wasn't emotionally invested, but I learned that I've been heavily emotionally invested. I told Gomati that take your time, just try and figure out what you want to do.
So Gomati was knee-deep in her master's degree, and it took her a little while to make a decision, but she decided that she really liked Prashant's his integrity and his honesty.
Eventually, at the end, I came to a point like, you know, I don't really care about other things as long as I find someone who is really a good guy and I know from heart that he has high moral standards, then I think I should marry him. That was the point that I came to when I decided that, yes, I should get engaged to Prashant.
And so they told their parents, and their parents pretty much took the baton and ran with it. And 9 months after they had started talking, they had a lavish, beautiful, gorgeous wedding. 3 days. Lots of flowers, lots of relatives. And I can tell you that the way these two look at each other, this is not a business arrangement. They are very tender and very sweet with each other.
I like talking to her. You get that comfortable to a point where you're able to almost tell somebody everything.
They love to watch TV. They're big fans of Game of Thrones. And they love to go out and eat ice cream.
We always go to Cold Stone Creamery. My favorite flavor is banana caramel crunch.
Rachel, I don't think this couple is going to move back to India. Prashant is 31 and Gomati's 25. They plan to make their lives here in Fremont, which is kind of sad for their families in a way.
So that means a lot of airplane trips back and forth between SFO and Chennai.
It does. You know, when you think about it, they never would have met if it weren't for a digital website like BharatMatrimony.com. I mean, their families in Chennai didn't know each other, and they didn't run in the same circles.
You know, Polly, I can't get over the fact that they each chose the first name on the list that their parents had put in front of them from BharatMatrimony.com, and just turned out to be the right choice. You can dig into more detail about all the stories you heard today at californiareport.org. Feel free to contact us, too, with your stories of love in the digital age. Email us at loveinthedigitalage@kqed.org, or like us on Facebook, or reach out on Twitter. I'm at Rachel Miro, one word.
I'm Gumati Ramakrishnan, and that's Love in the Digital Age on the California Report, a production of the KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can find all 4 episodes on iTunes. Our director this week is Susie Racho. Our engineer today is Howard Galman. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer, Rob Spate, and Seal Muller. The online team includes David Marks, David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price. Our interns are Kerry Klein, Laura Clements, and Natalia Estrada. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Maul-Leon, Ingrid Becker, and Holly Kernan.
And I'm Polly Stryker.
And I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.